It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. February 12th was the 211th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, the father of the theory of evolution. Over the last couple of decades, a movement to establish an International Darwin Day has been growing. A group in Iowa City celebrates Darwin Day every year by highlighting the work of modern evolutionary scientists and providing professional development for science teachers around the state. The celebration is this Friday and Saturday, February 21st and 22nd. And this hour, we'll be talking with three different people who'll be presenting their work. My first guest isn't a scientist. She's a historian. The books of Charles Darwin transformed our understanding of the world. But who was reading these books when they were published? How did this information travel? Elizabeth Yale has been studying these questions and more. She is a lecturer in the Department of History at the University of Iowa, and she's put together an interactive workshop called Illustrated Natural History in Victorian Britain, How Darwin and His Contemporaries Shared Knowledge in Books. The workshop will be at the University of Iowa Main Library Special Collections Friday morning at 11 a.m. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So when people come to your workshop, give me an idea of what you'll be showing them.
Right. So we've got a really great range of books pulled from the University of Iowa Library, Special Collections Library, as well as a couple of books from my own collection that I've been building. And the idea is to show folks a little bit of what the culture of science is like in the 19th century and what some of the sources of Darwin's work were, his own works, and then also some of the responses to them. So we'll have some really great, lavishly illustrated books on birds, some of Audubon's books on birds, for example. We'll have works on ethnography from the period, detailing the history of societies from around the globe. And then we'll have some works that I'm very excited about that are works by women that were written in response to Darwin's Descent of Man, which is a book I'm interested in, that kind of detail their reaction to what he had written. And then also kind of popular science textbook from the period as well to kind of show what's the broader culture of science and natural history in this period.
And of course, we know about Charles Darwin's famous travels on the HMS Beagle, but traveling and seeing specimens for yourself was something that was so incredibly difficult for people to do in the 1850s or the mid-19th century. So, I mean, these books must have been vital to anybody who was really interested in natural history.
Yeah. So if we think about Darwin's working practices, right, he's able to travel in the first half of his life. But then in the second half of his life, he's basically parked at this country home that he has in England. And he manages to amass so much information through building his own library, but also corresponding with people around the world. So having available to him and having the purchasing power, right, that not everybody had access to these materials because not everybody was as wealthy as, say, a Darwin, but the ability to assemble this library. And when we think about how he composed his scientific theories, it's really kind of a collaborative process through reading to others, writing them, exchanging information and correspondence, and really building up that bigger picture.
The illustrations in these books, you talk about lavishly illustrated books, that must have been also an essential element because words can only do so much to describe something.
Yes. So for sure that there's a really strong scientific content to the illustrations. When you're interested, as he was, so for Descent of Man in particular, which is the 1871 book that he writes that's about human evolution, one of the things he's really interested in is color in the natural world. And so if you're trying to study color, say, in birds and the evolution of colored plumage, being able to look at these colored illustrated books will really supplement what, you know, you might remember from your travels, or looking at dried and stuffed specimens, which aren't necessarily always in the best preserved quality. And so in some ways, the color in the books can be more vibrant and give you a more realistic picture.
Absolutely. And of course, the origin of the species, I think, gets the most attention from modern scientists or modern people interested in evolution. The Descent of Man was an incredibly important work. Tell me what drew your interest to The Descent of Man.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the sequel to Origin of Species, where in Origin, Darwin doesn't really talk about human evolution at all. He kind of stops short of making that big leap, right? Though, of course, all of his readers and all of those who are talking about him in kind of popular culture in that period immediately say, oh, of course, right, you're going to apply this to humans too. And then by 1871, he kind of gets this idea, okay, I'm going to write this book that goes into the human picture. And so I got really interested in this text when I was approached by a biologist, Jim Costa, who works down in North Carolina, to come up with an annotated edition of this text to help provide commentary and understanding of it for modern students, because it deals with a lot of really kind of difficult concepts where he's talking about the evolution of race. And of course, it's the 19th century, so we're talking about kind of the 19th century's understanding of race, right, which tended to sort of veer towards seeing very strong hierarchical differences between human beings and between groups. And then it also deals with a lot of ideas that have to do with Victorian ideas about men and women and gender and how women were supposed to behave versus women. So we want to take these ideas and be able to translate them and set them in historical context, really.
You mentioned the evolution of race, and Darwin is coming at that with a strong personal belief, a very strong personal perspective as an abolitionist. And of course, this was published in 1871, but slavery was not entirely a settled subject worldwide at that point. Tell me a little bit more about how that influenced his writings.
Right. So he has a strong family background, then himself has sort of a lifelong commitment to opposition to slavery and the slave trade. In addition to having this family background where he had many family members who were opposed to it, he also had some important experiences very early in his life. So when traveling on the HMS Beagle in the 1830s, when he goes to South America, which in this time period in South America, there were still places where slavery is practiced, and he witnessed the treatment of slaves in Brazil, for example. And he was horrified by the practices that he saw. And so one of the things that he's interested in advancing in Descent of Man is that there's a theory that's going around in this period, sort of the 19th century race science, that's advocating that different races are actually different species, which we know is bad science, right? And one of the things that Darwin is saying in Descent of Man is, no, actually, there's a unified origin for all humans around the globe. So he's trying to make an argument for the common origin of all humans.
When this book is published in 1871, information still travels pretty slowly. You talked about looking at some of the correspondence and how people responded to the books. Can you give me an idea of, I mean, if somebody published something that was that groundbreaking now, we'd know about it today and everybody would be talking about it. Then how long did it take for word to spread?
That's a great question. So by the late 19th century, you know, it's not too different. There's newspapers and journals that are printing reviews pretty rapidly of Darwin's book. So he was very careful about making sure that the right people got review copies. And you can look at his correspondence with his publisher, John Murray, to make sure that he places those review copies in the right place. So those would even be coming out right away. He's also, you know, he's somebody who's very conscious of his reputation and how he's viewed. And so he also was always eagerly seeking out translations, right? So he's making contact with a French translator, with a German translator, with others who would be able to take his ideas into new kind of segments. And similarly, arrangements for publication in the U.S. are made pretty rapidly after the U.K. edition comes out, or the British edition.
You mention a relationship between the genders. What does he write about that in The Descent of Man?
Oh, yeah. So that's a really controversial point in The Descent of Man. So Darwin has this whole theory that he's elaborating in The Descent of Man that he uses to explain the origins of sort of human difference and different human races. And it's called sexual selection. The idea is, and this is still sort of controversial today, scientists continue to debate about it, to sort of argue about it. The idea is that within the animal world, individuals of a species will select for mates based on beauty, that they go for the most beautiful, right? His great examples for this come from the bird world, where you have, say, the peahen selecting the peacock, and over many, many generations, you get extravagant tails on peacocks. So he says, okay, this is what applies in the animal world. Same thing in the human world, except that it's males doing the selecting and females are relatively passive. So he has this kind of, again, kind of coming from the culture of his time, this idea that, you know, women are the less active sex, they're more domestic, they're more restricted to sort of, you know, moral influence, but not an active life outside the home. So his vision of human biology and human society is very much structured by those ideas he has about how gender is supposed to work and how the home is supposed to be run.
It sounds very Victorian.
Yes, definitely.
Definitely a product of his time. The workshop that you've put together, what do people get to do when they come in? How do they interact with these materials?
So it's really about being able to handle the materials and look at them for your own self. So I will talk a little bit, and we'll hear a little bit from Margaret Gamm, who's the Director of Special Collections at the University of Iowa, about, you know, where these books came from, what they represent in terms of their connection to Darwin and illustrating popular culture in Victorian Britain. But then one of the things I really love to do is just to turn it over to the people who show up, and you have a chance to kind of browse between illustrated newspapers from the 1860s and 70s, science textbooks that children would have used at the same time period, and then responses to Darwin and Darwin's works themselves. So I'm looking forward to seeing what kinds of discoveries those who come to the workshop make when they take a look at the books.
And what do you hope people take away from the experience?
That's a great question. So one thing I hope that they take away from the experience is a sense that Darwin is sort of the big name that we all remember, right? That if you've heard of a scientist, maybe he's one of the scientists in history that you might have heard of, but that there's this whole kind of culture around him reading his work and responding to his work and also participating in the correspondence networks and the production of books that contributes to him being able to form those ideas. So I think that's really important. The second thing I'm really hoping for is that, you know, the theme of the workshop, of the whole sort of Darwin Day events over the next couple of days, is going to be around understanding race in modern society and thinking about ways that we can teach evolutionary biology in a way that doesn't reinforce structural racism in modern society. And I think going back to some of these sources to the 19th century to kind of see, well, where were Darwin's blind spots? How was he influenced by his own society? Can help us reflect better on thinking about, well, where are our blind spots? How can we make a better, fuller picture that incorporates everybody when we're thinking about, you know, our understanding of evolution.
Elizabeth Yale, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was great to be here.
Elizabeth Yale is a lecturer in the Department of History at the University of Iowa. She's put together an interactive workshop called Illustrated Natural History in Victorian Britain, How Darwin and His Contemporaries Shared Knowledge in Books. We'll continue our preview of Iowa City's Darwin Day in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're getting a preview of this year's Darwin Day celebration in Iowa City. It's coming up this Friday and Saturday. DNA and human genetic diversity are big focuses of this year's Darwin Day. And I'll be talking with two different researchers who've delved into DNA research in different ways. And my next guest is Anya Prince, an associate professor of law and a member of the University of Iowa Genetics Cluster. On Saturday, she'll be giving a talk entitled Ancestry Testing, Privacy, and the Law, and she is here with me now. Hello, Anya.
Hi.
So genetics testing, these DNA tests that we can get for a fairly low down payment, we can have it sent to our home, we can take the swab, we can send it in, and we can find out all kinds of things about ourselves. These have become very, very popular, and we'll talk a little later on with a researcher who deals with a lot of the numbers that can come from this kind of testing. But when you get this kind of test, beyond the little pedigree that you get, what happens to all of this information?
Yeah. So you're right. A lot of people have gotten this test, right? There's estimates that 26 million people worldwide
Wow.
have done DTC, or direct-to-consumer genetic testing. And so those customers get back their ancestry, right? Oh, I'm 45% this, 45% this. But the company gets your data, right? They get your entire genome. And so the question really is what they do with that. And you mentioned the low, low cost, right? One of the things about this business is that the money for the companies aren't necessarily in selling the kits to you. They're what they can get out of the value.
Right.
Of that
so you
data.
Feel like you're the customer,
mm-hmm.
but really you're not the customer.
You're the product in a way.
All right. So this information that, you know, we get back is really just a small part of the information that they can glean from these tests, right?
Yeah, that they can glean or what we're trying to figure out, right? So a couple of different things can happen with your data once it goes to these companies. One is it can be used for research, right? And this is in the privacy statements that you sign, that you click on that says, yes, 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 that's what they're going to do with all of my data and what they're going to collect. And so this could be research in collaboration with pharmaceutical companies to figure out, okay, people with this genetic marker, do they have this type of disease, and what can we learn? So there can be some really beneficial genetic research that comes out of it. But you're not necessarily asked about each particular project, right? You don't know what's happening to your data after you click, yes, I'm fine with it being used for research.
Right. So, I mean, and definitely this kind of research that you could be contributing to could be contributing to the greater good in some really powerful ways. I think a lot of people feel really good about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one estimate I saw was about 80% of people from 23andMe said, yes, I would like my data used for research. Right. But do they, you know, how much do they understand about what's happening with that? And then, you know, 23andMe, for example, partnered with GlaxoSmithKline for $300 million. And so there's a lot of money in those collaborations and drug development that could happen. And you don't see that. In fact,
right.
you're paid to be part of that. Right?
More than giving it away, you're actually paying a small fee to participate in that research.
Yeah.
So how long have you been thinking about this and researching this?
Yeah. So I fell in love with this topic in law school. Actually, everybody always asks, well, what are you doing, a lawyer, talking, you know, in Darwin Day and talking about genetics? But I became really interested based on a class I took in law school on the societal aspects of genetic testing. And so for about 10 years now, since law school graduation, I have been working in the field of genetic discrimination. So looking at how employers and insurers and law enforcement and all of those different people can access your genetic information and what they can do with it.
All right. So, and you've really watched this whole explosion of genetic testing in that 10-year period, because it really wasn't as easily available even 10 years ago as it is now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So this genetic information that we're giving up, it's supposed to be stripped of our identity for the most part, right?
Yeah. So when we talk about the research aspect, right, so the data that comes to the companies and then is used for research, when they send it out to GlaxoSmithKline or other pharmaceutical companies, all of your identifiers are taken away. So they pull together all of their millions of people and can send that data out. And that is ruled by federal regulations. The common rule, any research that's done has to have informed consent unless it's anonymous. And so as long as they comply with those rules, they can use your data for research. But there are other ways that people can access information from direct-to-consumer that isn't anonymous. So law enforcement sometimes uses genetic information.
And we've heard some pretty high-profile stories about law enforcement using this information.
Absolutely. Yeah. Here in Iowa, there's a case going on this week about a cold case murder that they discovered the potential, you know, the alleged murderer based on DNA and family DNA.
Now, when you hear about a possible murderer being brought to justice because of DNA testing, again, that sounds like a really positive thing, but it also makes people really nervous. Why?
Yeah. So just taking a step back, what happened is what some people do, they get their information from these ancestry testing companies, and sometimes they can get their raw data back, and they can upload those to public-facing databases. And so because that's public, it's really great because you can find family matches. But the police started using those websites as well. So they'd say, oh, we have this blood sample from a crime scene and we don't know whose it is. So let's go into that public database and check it out. And so there's a lot of questions about how much we should allow police to use that information, because it's not just, oh, I, Anya Prince, submitted my sample. It's I might have a third cousin who did something, right? They find my sample and it looks a little bit linked. They know it's not me, but they know it's somebody in my family, and they can go track down people. And we're to the point where in these public databases and in these ancestry databases, we can identify basically everybody of European descent. through these databases. And so the police have a lot of access to everybody's test, right? And we live in a society where we wouldn't want the police to be able to just knock on everybody's door and say, hey, give us your blood just so we can, just in case somebody in your family commits a crime. We don't live in that type of society. Police have to get warrants and have individualized suspicion. But when it's publicly available like that, they're going to use the resources.
Right. We've done it voluntarily without thinking about the fact that that is what we're doing.
Or our family members have done it voluntarily.
Right. So, again, it's hard when you think about the fact that possible murderers are being brought to justice. That still sounds really positive. So what is the downside? What are the things that really concern you?
So what concerns me is the slippery slope, right? So so the high-profile cases that have been publicized now are serial killers, right? Really, really, really awful crimes. Where do we draw the line, right? So, okay, serial killers, sexual assault, murder, right? But what about a serious assault? There was a case where a state database, this wasn't publicly available, but a state database had a requirement that you needed to have, it needed to be a serious crime. But this familial search was used to when a car window was broken into and $1.40 was stolen. So is that really the type of thing where we should be using these tools for that petty of a crime, right? And how comfortable are we with that slippery slope? I think the other thing to keep in mind is that this isn't foolproof, right? There's a story of the police identifying a person, knocking on his door, getting a warrant, and then he was the wrong guy, right? And so, okay, he wasn't arrested, but his neighbor saw the police, you know, around his house. Maybe his employer heard of it. What happens then? And so it's not, we can have a lot of innocent people sort of in the mix as well.
Well, and you mentioned, okay, we've gotten to a point where we can identify almost everyone from European descent. So this brings up a really interesting question about the database.
Yeah.
Because this is something that people have opted into. People often of privilege have opted into it because it's a service that you pay for and it's a luxury item. It's certainly not something that you need to have. So tell me about how this database does or does not reflect our society.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, for the private databases, right, or the people who get direct-to-consumer testing, it's predominantly European descent. And so in a way, this actually helps balance out police use of DNA because our federal and state criminal databases, which comes from people who are arrested or convicted of crime, is disproportionately minority because we have a disproportionate amount of minorities who are arrested and convicted, right? And so in a way, this balances that out by having now the more white population also be exposed to police intervention. But on the flip side, if we think about those research aspects that I talked about, then we have our research coming from a predominantly European descent.
Which has been a problem throughout history already.
Yes. And so then drugs that are developed, treatments that are developed, associations that are identified are skewed towards a more privileged group.
All right. So having people opting into this system and then become the people that are the focus of this research can skew the research to benefit those people who have paid the price and opted into the system.
Exactly.
Over long term. So let's talk a little bit more about some of the other possible problems with giving up this data. If I have a genetic problem and somebody figures out a drug that works for that, again, that seems really positive. Mm-hmm. But there could also be a possibility for discrimination based on someone's genetic makeup because of these databases. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So let's say I take so one thing to note is what information you're getting back, right? If it's ancestry testing, that probably isn't used for discrimination that much because people aren't interested in that. But if you find out that you have a predisposition to some sort of condition like cancer, right, then maybe that's of interest to a life insurer or an employer, right? An employer under our federal law, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, health insurers and covered employers aren't allowed to discriminate on the basis of genetics, but that doesn't include educational facilities, life insurers, long-term care insurers, lenders, mortgage companies, right? You could list a whole bunch that aren't covered by that. And so one of the things I really look into in my research is, would they want to use this information? Is it actually helpful for them? And what are the ways that law and policy can prevent misuse?
So do you feel like law and policy is behind on this?
It's definitely behind, right? Especially because, GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, was passed in 2008. And if we think about all of the ways that genetic testing has changed, we have epigenetic testing, we have multiple, polygenic testing now. We have all of these new technologies that don't necessarily fit into our definitions of genetic testing that are enshrined in the law.
All right. So we haven't caught up with the science, which is also a problem that we've had repeatedly throughout our history. We have seen the popularity of these tests possibly peak from what you see. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So in the last couple of months, there's been news stories of different direct-to-consumer testing companies laying off some employees or seeing a decline in testing. And people are really curious about why, right? So maybe it's that we've reached saturation. There's, a lot of people who wanted to be those first people who did the genetic testing. It's lost some of that panache, right? It could be that people are starting to hear more and more about these cases of privacy concerns, and they're thinking about that. Could be that they've heard so many stories of people learning about family members that they didn't know they had, right, that they're wary of doing this. And so there's all of these implications that maybe people are taking into account, or it's just a blip, right? Maybe it's just the 6 months, it slowed down a little bit.
What do you want people who come to your talk and people who are listening right now to take away from this conversation? Because, it certainly raises some questions about privacy, but it raises much bigger questions too.
Yeah. So I think one of the really big pieces is thinking about data flow, right? Thinking about what information you're giving, what information you're getting back, and what information you're giving and not getting back, but that's being given elsewhere. And that's from the individual perspective. From the societal perspective, I think it's really important to think about that data flow on a society perspective of, like we talked about, disparities being perpetuated because of the way that the information is being used in society and traveling from researchers to insurers to employers and vice versa.
So I'm going to ask you a very personal question. Mm-hmm. Have you done one of these tests?
I have not, no. When people say, oh, I just talked to you and now I shouldn't, I say, no, it makes sense. If you get value from it, then that's fine. But understand where your data might go.
Well, and okay, and understanding where our data might go, I think that it's hard to really get the full picture of that. And you talked about how policy hasn't really caught up with the science. Do we fully understand where the data might go? If you're looking at the picture right now, it's changed so much since mm-hmm. you started yeah. looking at this. Where do you think it might go in the next 10 years?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think we don't know, right? So I guess part of it is understanding where the data currently goes and then understanding that this is fluid and being comfortable with that, right? So I think that's one of the reasons I love this field is because we don't know what it'll look like in 10 years. We'll always sort of be faced with challenges from the law and policy to try our best to catch up with science.
Right.
Over and over
because
again.
We have this huge database and it's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. We have already donated that information to these companies, and the information is going to continue to be valuable. Mm-hmm. So even if people suddenly aren't so interested in buying these kits, mm-hmm. this field is not going anywhere.
No, right. And there'll be more and more efforts, right? So either other companies or other research projects. The federal government is running a huge All of Us research project that's trying to find these associations as well. Your next speaker will talk about all of the benefits that can come from learning about that. So I by no means mean that we shouldn't be giving our genetic data and participating in this, but I think it's important to just think about the implications of it as well.
Absolutely. Well, it is fascinating work, Anya. And what is your next question? You've been looking a lot at the big questions so far. Is there a next frontier that you want to explore?
Yeah. So one of the things that is changing a lot in how we think about genetic testing is previously, a lot of the genetic testing we've done has been one gene connected with a disease. So BRCA or Huntington's disease, BRCA is linked to breast and ovarian cancer, right? One gene, one disease. But we're starting to get more and more learning about the interaction of multiple genes and how they contribute. And that raises really interesting questions if insurers use that information. And so it's of a similar kind, but it's just stretching how we think about this a little bit more.
Well, Anya, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Anya Prince is an associate professor of law and a member of the University of Iowa Genetics Cluster. She'll be part of Darwin Day in Iowa City on Saturday. She'll give a talk entitled Ancestry Testing, Privacy, and the Law. You can find out more about Iowa City's Darwin Day at iowacitydarwinday.org. And coming up in just a moment, we'll talk more about this DNA genetic database that we have access to and what we can learn about ourselves from it. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're getting a preview of this year's Darwin Day celebration in Iowa City. It's coming up on Friday and Saturday. And we're going to continue our conversation about DNA and human genetic diversity now with John Novembre. He's a computational biologist and a professor of human genetics and ecology and evolution at the University of Chicago. He also received a MacArthur Fellowship for his work in 2015. On Saturday, his presentation is Human Genetic Diversity, Understanding Ourselves Through the Lens of DNA. Hello, John.
Hi.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. And I was just talking with Anya Prince about this incredible database that has been created because people have decided to swab themselves and send their DNA off to companies. So we've talked about some of the pitfalls, but on the bright side, we're living in a time that really makes it possible for us to understand our genetics in ways that we could really only guess at before, the kind of guessing that Charles Darwin was doing back when he wrote The Descent of Man. And now you're doing the same kind of work, but with genetic databases. Is that how you think about it?
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah, thanks for having me. And yeah, you're absolutely right. So the kinds of questions that Darwin was asking in The Descent of Man, we continue to ask, and we continue to gain insight from using genetic data. And in my talk, I'll be revisiting some of those questions, showing what we've learned about our species through the lens of DNA. I'm a computational biologist. I've spent most of my career analyzing these large data sets of DNA sequences, and so I'll be sharing some of the insights my colleagues and I have gained from that work.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those questions that Darwin was asking and the questions that you're asking. I mean, the big question is really how all humans are related to each other, right?
That's right. That was the biggest question that Darwin was asking. And as Elizabeth so nicely said, Darwin, a key part of his argument was establishing the single common ancestry of all humans, that we are one species despite all of our diversity. And now we can see that in exquisite detail with the evidence of molecules, and we can actually get a sense of the timescales that were involved and measure sort of how many millions of years it was back to our separation from the common ancestor with other primates, and on what timescales have human groups been diverging and spreading out across the planet.
It also seems that I have been reading a lot of information recently about new insights into our relationships with our primate cousins and how we may have interacted with some of those other species as we diverged from that common ancestor. Can your work tell you about that, or is that a different branch?
No, that's related. Absolutely. Yeah. So that's I think you're referring to the amazing work that has shown how modern humans, as we spread out across the planet, interacted with other archaic humans like Neanderthals, Denisovans, and just recently reported their signatures of an archaic ancestor that was possibly living in West Africa that contact was made with as well, and that there was mixing with. In the big picture, part of what I'll be sharing is that those contributions were extremely small. So we see them now that we have the advantage of using ancient DNA data and very sophisticated computational methods and that we know to look for it. But it's actually, on first glance, as you look at most human genetic data, the main storyline that you see is our recent origin altogether in Africa.
That's really interesting. And I want you to spell this out for us a little bit, because I think a lot of us don't really grasp this. When we get, if we participate in one of those DNA companies, we get this sort of pedigree that we get back that tells us a little bit about where we come from and our immediate ancestors. And there's a difference between pedigree ancestors and genetic ancestors. So define pedigree ancestors for me.
Yeah, so pedigree ancestors are the ancestors that exist in your family tree as we go back every generation. So you have, you know, your two parents, your four grandparents, your eight great-grandparents, and so on. Those are your pedigree ancestors.
Okay, and then what's the difference then with genetic ancestors?
Yeah, so your genetic ancestors are the ones that actually have passed on DNA to you. So because any of us only get to pass on half of our DNA to our offspring, there's some amount of DNA that gets lost every generation. And so there's a distinction in the ancestry proportions that you get out of this test versus what you would actually see if you counted up the number of your pedigree ancestors and said, you know, where did you come from? That's not necessarily going to match the proportions of DNA that you have today because of this random amount of loss that happens in each generation.
So our connection with those ancestors is not as strong as we might like to think?
Well, it just means that that's one reason to have a grain of salt as you look at the results of genetic ancestry tests. And there's another one that's interesting too, which is thinking about the time scale of these ancestry tests. And so, for instance, when you learn via these tests that you're 40% of some group versus 60% of some other, they rarely tell you at what time scale that's on. And so if we were to ask, say, for me, just a generation ago, where were my ancestors and sort of what proportion should I have? I might come up as 50% from Queens, New York, where my dad was born, and 50% from the small town of Minas, where my mother was born. But if we go 100,000 years ago, all of my ancestors would have been in Africa. So I'm essentially 100% African. These ancestry tests give you an answer that's somewhere in between. It's somehow a sense of like where your ancestors came from before all of the big migrations that took place recently, but it's not really precise. And so we need to take that into account and read these results with a grain of salt for that reason.
As you mentioned earlier, humans are a diverse species. When we look at some of our primate cousins, and this is also because of our ability to discern differences, but if you look at bonobos or chimpanzees, we don't see them as distinctly different as we see humans being from each other. And so the fact that humans can come in such a wide variety of different eye colors, hair colors, skin colors, et cetera, that raises questions and has raised questions for people through history about how humans are all related to each other. So when you look at this data, tell me how that shows up.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. You're absolutely right that this has been a perplexing problem for generations of thinkers. And it was one of the key questions that Darwin was thinking about. It's why when Elizabeth mentioned that there was a big interest in understanding color variation in birds, et cetera, is that he was trying to understand the morphological diversity of humans. How are we so diverse? And that actually lies in contrast to our genetic diversity, which is relatively low. So we are actually, if we look at the pairwise sort of number of differences between two pieces of DNA for two pieces of human DNA, we see the numbers really low, like one difference every 1,000 base pairs. So if DNA were like a staircase and you had to climb every step being a base pair, you'd have to climb 1,000 steps to hit the first difference between two humans. It turns out that that number is very similar to what you see in chimpanzees or gorillas. So we have similar and even lower levels of diversity than our primate cousins at the DNA level. Yet phenotypically, like our skin pigmentation, et cetera, we can look so different. So there's that kind of paradox there. And what the molecular data reveal is that skin pigmentation genes, eye color, hair color, really stick out in the genome. They're the sore thumbs. They're really aberrant. There are these places where there's a lot more difference in the genome than that our average biology has. And we couldn't really understand that until getting the detailed molecular data. So that might be a lot to grasp. I'm going to try to explain that in the talk with more detail and some visualizations.
All right. Well, and tell me how we understand it now. Now that we can look at the molecular data, what does that tell us?
Yeah. So it tells us that phenotypes like skin color are the outliers. So, like, ironically, the things that we're seeing when we look at one another and use to establish a sense of difference are actually, if we extrapolate that to the rest of the genome, we'd get it wrong. We would exaggerate how much difference there is underneath us. So in some real genetic sense, skin pigmentation and sort of the sense of race that's built on that is misleading. It's really only skin deep.
You've also written that these phenotypic changes are relatively recent in our evolution. Can you explain that for me?
Yeah. So the big picture that unites us is understanding how, as a species, we began in Africa, spread out across the planet relatively rapidly on an evolutionary timescale. And so there hasn't been enough time for large amounts of diversity to accumulate. And then local adaptation to things like different levels of sunlight have made a relatively quick change in a few places in the genome, those underlying things like skin pigmentation and a few other categories. We see changes in genes related to infectious disease resistance, to dietary, different diets that existed across the planet. But in the evolutionary timescale, those are all relatively quick.
All right. And it sounds like then influenced by our environment.
Yes. Yeah. The different environments that humans have moved out and into. Yeah.
So this is obviously a really important conversation to have. And it's one that people have manipulated over the years to serve their own purposes. How can we have this conversation, do you feel, in really the most useful way?
That's a great question. And I think you're absolutely right that there is a natural tension, and it's actually naturally uncomfortable sometimes to talk about these topics. And we need to face that. But and we need to talk about it. It is important because there are groups with strong ideologies that are trying to use the new information coming out of genetics and cherry pick from it to support simplistic ideas of racism that go back to the kind of simple notions that existed before Darwin. And so in that context, it's become more and more important for geneticists to become comfortable speaking about genetic diversity and helping show the data, which is a big part of my goal in the talk, is to, and a part of my research is developing tools for data visualization. So to help make the data more transparent, to prevent these misinterpretations, to prevent sort of simplistic readings of what is a really pretty amazing story when you look at it, and a fascinating sort of collection of footprints of movements of our ancestors that you see in our genetic data.
There's a workshop taking place at Darwin Day on Friday, and the title of that workshop is Playing with Fire: How We Perpetuate Biological Beliefs About Race in the Classroom and How We Can Avoid It. And you're not part of that workshop, but I think that that is something that a lot of people who teach evolution, people who teach biology, are afraid of, having those conversations about race in the classroom. What would you want to communicate to science teachers, to biology teachers, about what they should be saying as they look at your research and other research?
Yeah, so I think that clear communication about these issues actually helps people understand them and helps diffuse kind of simplistic ideas about race. And Brian Donovan, who's in the group presenting that workshop, has published work that's suggested that actually more exposure to the genetic data actually helps people have a more sophisticated understanding of genetic and human diversity and breaks down simplistic ideas about race. So I think we need to engage this topic rather than shying away from it.
All right. Not be afraid to talk about race and biology. That's your recommendation. As you have had really access to this incredible database over the years, and we are living in this incredible age of so much information, what is your next frontier for research? What do you hope to accomplish?
There's many interesting things. Let's see. We have been developing these methods for using genetic data to understand patterns of gene flow and in ways that are more continuous and sort of respect the continuum that exists across human populations, how neighboring populations are almost always mixing with one another. And we've gotten a sort of foothold in that space, but there are a number of different extensions we want to make that can help model like long-range migrations and directional migrations and so on. So that's one of the areas I'm most excited about right now.
Well, and back when I was talking to Anya, we were talking about how a large portion of the genetic database that we can work with has been given by sort of a skewed group of people who want to buy these kits and learn about their research. Is that frustrating for you as you're doing genetic research, or are you able to work around that?
Yeah. Every data set that you can find for human genetic diversity is somehow limited. Even the ones that try to get a diverse sampling are missing huge sections of the world. That is absolutely a challenge. It is interesting in terms of the conversation about its impacts for medicine, in that it kind of cuts two ways. I think in a way, having an understanding of how similar we are as humans actually reminds us that the things that we learn about genetics from one population oftentimes port to another. So if a genetic study finds a possible drug target from investigation in one population, it most often will work in other populations. But it's in a second application of genetic data, which is in doing prediction of disease risk, where there's a stronger concern about the biases that exist by the immense overrepresentation of European ancestry in the existing genetic databases.
Well, John Novembre, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much.
John Novembre is a computation biologist and a professor of human genetics and ecology and evolution at the University of Chicago. He'll be at Darwin Day in Iowa City talking about human genetic diversity, understanding ourselves through the lens of DNA. You can find out more about Darwin Day at iowacitydarwinday.org. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.